Congrats to everyone that recently matched at Genetic Counseling Programs, especially our own communications lead, Corinne Merlino. She's going to be going to the University of Pennsylvania this fall, and we're very proud and excited for her. I also wanted to share, for those that didn't match, that it is very competitive, and many of the best genetic counselors I know applied multiple times. So I really encourage you to apply again. In the spirit of recent match day, graduations coming up, DNA day, we thought it was the perfect time for our next giveaway. This time we're giving away GC Genius's top two study materials for genetics, their study guide and their flashcards. These feature the top 100 genetic conditions to know. And fun fact, our graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian, who did our DNA Today logo, was the lead creator of these flashcards. And I gotta say, they're beautiful. And Ashlyn's been on a bunch of DNA Today episodes. Look in the show notes if you wanna check those out. At the time I'm recording this, the giveaway has only been live for a few hours and we've already surpassed 600 entries. So it's our most popular giveaway ever. And I wanted to make sure that you guys knew about it so that you could enter, because the giveaway ends May 1st. So you can head over to our social media at DNA Today Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can even enter on all three to increase your chances of winning. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention, because DNA Day just passed, that we did launch our Patreon. So would love to see you guys head over there and check out all the awesome benefits we have, like monthly Zoom calls together, one-on-one mentorship, DNA Today merch. We've got so much going on. It's a really big week for DNA Today. And you guys have this awesome episode. It was really, really fun to record. So, all right, I'll stop blabbering. Here's the episode.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. For over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. We are going back in time in this episode of DNA Today to explore the history of the genetic counseling field. We're focused on the first annual conference for genetic counselors, NSGC, which was, I believe, in 1981, so 54 years ago. So obviously, I don't know too much about this because I wasn't around. So I'm joined by two rock stars in the field of genetic counseling, and usually I give like a quick like, okay, who is this person, like a one-liner. We need way more than one line for this. So Michelle Fox is an adjunct associate professor of pediatrics at UCLA. For over 30 years, Michelle has coordinated the UCLA Genetics Clinic, provided genetic counseling services to both pediatric and adult populations, including the UCLA Predictive Huntington Disease Testing Program, early onset Alzheimer's, and genetic neurodegenerative disorders. That's even just a mouthful to say, let alone actually practice. Michelle is a faculty member of the UCLA Genetic Counseling Program, and she was very recently honored in 2022 at the last NSGC with the Natalie Weisberger Paul Lifetime Achievement Award. And I didn't even realize you were getting this until I was sitting in the crowd and I was like, oh my God, Michelle's getting the award. So for all of your amazing contributions to the field of genetic counseling. Our other lovely guest is Deborah Collins, who has been a genetic counselor at the University of Kansas Medical Center for 4 decades. Her current roles include that of a hereditary cancer genetic counselor and advisor to the medical student genetics and neoplasia curricula and the medical student genetics special interest group. She also has been awarded. So she's been awarded the Jane Engelberg Memorial Fellowship 2006 Special Award for an online genetic course for genetic counselors. She has been one of our presidents of NSGC in 1988 and has served on the board for directors of American College of Medical Genetics, American Board of Genetic Counselors, and was the principal investigator for Human Genome Project grants through the Department of Energy. Oh my goodness, you guys have quite the career in genetics. As soon as we got on this call, I was like, bow down to the OGs, genetic counselors. I am just honored to have you guys on the show. So thank you so much for taking time out of your busy lives and your busy careers.
Thank you for having us. It's very exciting for us to be here.
Are you interested in the rapidly growing field of genetics and want to learn more about clinical genetics, molecular genetics, and laboratory sciences? Then you should check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. By taking part in this program, you're going to be joining both national and international learners with the same passion for genetics. Interact directly with your Johns Hopkins instructors and fellow learners throughout the program. Limited spots are available for the summer cohort starting June 5th, 2023. For more information, use the link in our show notes. If you're listening to this through a podcast app, you can also access the link at dnatoday.com. Want to become a genetic counselor? Looking for ways to engage with the field and boost your resume for grad school applications? Then you should check out Sarah Lawrence's Why Genetic Counseling Wednesday Summer Series. Every Wednesday this June, plus the last Wednesday in May, Sarah Lawrence is hosting a series where you can interact through Zoom with genetic counselors from different specialties. It kicks off on May 31st. You can sign up at slc.edu/DNA today. Again, visit slc.edu/DNA today to register to level up your resume for applications in the fall. Many people are familiar. If they listen to the show, they know that the genetic counseling field is a young profession, especially compared to other areas of science and healthcare. So it's been around for a little over 50 years now. And, you know, back in, I forget which episode it was, but I had Linda Robinson on, who's also an OG GC. And you guys like have your own little group, I think. So
we sure do.
We talked about why it's important to understand the history of the field. And I think we should kind of address that before we dive into and, you know, get into our time machine and go back to the first NSGC. So Michelle, why don't we start with you? Why is it important for us to understand the history of the profession, especially for people that have graduated in recent years?
Well, I think it's so important because we grew up because the genetic technologies expanded. And with that expansion has been so dramatic. In fact, we don't even realize how fast it is and how dramatic it is. So our field grew up because, very frankly, the healthcare professionals needed someone to explain all these genetic technologies to patients and families and other healthcare providers. So I think that led rapidly to our expansion in our field about what we could talk about, what we needed to talk about, and the fact that everybody needs a genetic counselor.
Things have changed so much in the last 50 years. Deborah, anything to add on to that?
Well, you know, I think we were just in some ways really lucky. We tumbled onto it. We were passionate about it. We were, excited about being together, being around other genetic counselors, both in our graduate programs. Then we went out to work. Things were happening. There were a lot of, it was a field that was young because most of the people you're reading the papers or meeting were still alive. You know, they had just trained in the last 20 years. So we were meeting all the big names in genetics at all of the meetings that we went to. And it was a very exciting time. It still is.
We really grew up as the technology grew up. Mm-hmm. And that was a very, very special place to be, as Deb said. It was very, very special for us.
I just can't imagine, like, you know, I'm thinking about just me and, like, you know, whatever amount of decades looking back on everything. But for you guys, it's like we started with such limited genetic testing specifically. And now to see, like, oh, just order a whole genome. Like, did you guys ever imagine we just be like, oh, just order a whole genome? Like, I mean, wasn't even a thing to do in the world. Like, we didn't even have the technology back then.
Just to put it in context, let me just tell you, on the first board exam, there was not one question about molecular genetics. So think
about
that.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, because the two genes, sickle cell and CF, were just going to be mapped. I mean, that was the very, very beginning. There was no human genome project. There was no internet. There was no fax. There were no cell phones. I can tell you what we had to do. Deb and I can tell you what we had to do to find a researcher that would take a blood sample from one of our patients. I mean, it was really daunting, really daunting.
Most of the testing was done at academic medical centers. And the way you found out about it is you take the first author on the paper, or sometimes the last author.
Oh, you had to go to the library to look that up in a book called Index Medicus, okay? Which nobody would remember but us. I don't know if anybody else
never even heard of it. Yep.
Ever heard of that. Okay.
And you would write to the author and ask for their paper, because you may or may not, you know, have access to that.
Oh, you might try to call them on the phone.
Yes.
Because, again, there was no other way to contact that person. And they were often gone because they would be the fellow or the researcher that was gone to another thing. So they weren't even at that institution.
I mean, you're just constantly tracking people down. I mean, that sounds like it was a big chunk of the job that, I mean, nowadays, you know, we're just Googling and finding that person so quickly, even if they've changed positions, like you can still contact them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's wild to think about how much has changed in 50 years. And one of the years that I think about as being the most important when we're looking at the early foundation of the field is 1969. Can you inform our audience, Deborah, why this is an important year in our profession?
That was the year Sarah Lawrence enrolled the first class of genetic counselors. They had seen an ad in the New York magazine, which was actually being covered the birth defects meetings, and there was some mention of this program was going to happen. The program was not aware that they weren't quite ready for it. And all of a sudden people were calling and they put a program together for all those people. So it was pretty amazing the way it all came about.
Yeah, it's just interesting. People always comment to me like, Sarah Lawrence seems to be such a random place for genetic counseling to have started. And kind of, but not really. Like, yeah, it's not an academic center or like linked with a specific big, huge hospital. But it kind of makes sense because the field started with a lot of, and correct me if I'm getting things wrong here, please. But from my understanding, the field started with a lot of women that were, you know, either recently married or had kids and were kind of looking for like a part-time job, something else to really just add to their life and what they were doing on a daily basis. So that seemed to be, you know, kind of in that context makes sense. It was at a liberal arts school in Westchester where a lot of people were coming from money and had time and energy and money to spend on grad school. So when you look at it from that perspective, like it was an all women's college back in the day. I don't know if it was in 69 though. Was it still a women's college?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It was? Okay.
Yeah, longer than that. But we have to remember this was an extraordinary group of women. Extraordinary. Melissa Richter was originally the person at Sarah Lawrence that had this vision and reaching out to people like Audrey Heinler to make this happen. And what a privilege to know Audrey, as Deb and I know her. But just amazing women with a vision, very smart. And Audrey can tell you that it was a lot of it was really serendipitous, to be honest, which is a lot of life. I mean, Deb and I can talk about our serendipity in our career.
Yeah, but you know, and the headquarters of the March of Dimes is just north of Sarah Lawrence. And I think Beverly Rolnick was somehow affiliated with that as well. So the birth defects meetings were in New York and Virginia Apgar had given a talk. So, I mean, it was the right place, the right time, or serendipitous. Yeah, that there
that
were
makes sense.
A number of things that came together.
Yeah. And a lot of these names, people are probably like, why are all of these names familiar? Not just because they're, you know, OG genetic counselors, but a lot of things at NSGC are named after so many of these people that you've mentioned, like the Rolnick Lecture. It's just so interesting. And there's something named after Audrey, too, I believe, right?
Because yes, the name the is Audrey very yes. special projects. Yes.
There we go.
And Joan Marks, of course, who,
yes.
You know, without Joan, I mean, we can't speak highly enough of the experience of our first meeting with Joan, formidable, just amazing. And her words of wisdom ring in my ears every day. It just the way it is, you know?
Yeah, everyone that I've talked to that had Joan as their program director, which is a lot of people in our field, have said the same exact thing. And she wasn't the first director, but she was like, the director for the most amount of years. I mean, the program is named after mm-hmm. her now. But it's very, very interesting. I graduated from there, you know, a couple years ago. But so the other date and year that I wanted to mention is we're really going to get into here is the first annual education conference. So, you know, NSGC is everybody's, you know, refers to it now. So when and where was this held? I mean, who was involved in this? Michelle, you're smiling, so you get to answer first.
Well, it was a combination of getting some funding for March of Dimes to lead to that meeting in San Diego at the Town and Country, and I could picture it around the swimming pool. You know, it was just an amazing meeting. There were, I think, 182 of us. Is that right, Deb?
Yeah,
about that.
Approximately. Yeah. We looked
which was
up.
Just about all the genetic counselors that existed at that time. Okay, so just remember, this is before certification, this is before licensure, this is just the people basically that had graduated from Sarah Lawrence and Berkeley, because the program at Berkeley was around at that time too. So that was us. That was the very beginning. And the excitement of seeing each other and being together just can't be minimized. It was an amazing experience.
We were scattered all over the country, sometimes the only person in our state or our city or our institution. And we knew about these other meetings, but to be in the lobby and then here walks in another one of your colleagues and then another colleague, it was just a magical time to see everybody and then just talk about genetic counseling. And you could just cut through so many things and everybody understands so much about you. And you're talking, and you know, at that time, people didn't know what a genetic counselor was, couldn't pronounce
it. And they still don't, but that's another discussion.
I know, that's why I hesitated saying that was different. We didn't have prenatal diagnosis yet, but you know, at some point, the meetings everybody could pronounce amniocentesis at some point in the world. So that was interesting. But and we had access to the big names in genetics because they were at the birth defects meeting. So we were able to tap into the expertise there and they'd stay over or come a day earlier and be at our meeting as well. And I think what I liked was the little workshops a lot of times where you'd be sitting with a group of people on a topic and you'd talk to each other from, you know, for whatever it was, whether it was a condition or a clinical practice or some challenge or something. And it was great because you're back there by yourself and here's a bunch of people that do things just like you.
And the MD geneticists that attended the first meetings that we had in conjunction either with the March of Dimes or then a little bit later with American Society of Human Genetics, they literally wrote the books. Dr. McCusick, Dr. Amoyne, all of the huge names, Dr. Gorlin, all the people that, all the syndrome, David Smith, the syndromes were named for, were at that meeting. Those were the people that we got to know by being at meetings together. And I only wish the young genetic counselors had that opportunity because it was really beyond compare.
I would be fangirling the whole time. I don't even know if I could have conversations with these people. Like
it was amazing. Wow. And that was key, Kira, because they were approachable because we were in meetings together. I guess we could talk about the dinner dance. So between NSGC, we had meetings back to back with American Society of Human Genetics, and Saturday night in between, we had a dinner dance. Now, if you could imagine,
reception.
It was a reception. Sometimes,
but it was.
But there was
music
there
and
was
dancing,
food, and there was liquor, and there was dancing. Okay,
so it sounds like a genetics prom to me.
It was great. So you have to see all these young women and all these old guys. It would never fly today.
Right.
What's
exactly
going on in our society. But we had a rollicking good time, and it was really a wonderful way to get to know each other. And then they were instrumental. We were able to send them blood samples because we met them at the meeting and we remind them, hey, you know, I met you at the meeting and now I have a patient with this, you know, rare syndrome.
It was a good introduction because then it made it very comfortable to call their office and ask for things. And we did have conversations with them about their work as well. But, you know, it was just smoother. You were part, for me, I'm in Kansas City. I felt like I was part of this big world of genetics, just happened to be working in Kansas City. So I never felt like I was just here. I felt like I was part of this very big thing that was happening with all these other people all over the country, but really the world too.
And putting this into perspective, I mean, this was 1981 was the first one, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, back then, yeah, you couldn't just hop on a Zoom or have things where you're connecting with people. You could pick up the phone and everything, right? But, I mean, it's so different if you don't have these relationships, or it's like, okay, the few people that were in your class, maybe you're keeping up with them, but just the networking that was available, that's really the main time every year you guys were doing this. So, as you were saying, like a good percentage of genetic counselors would be coming to these meetings because it was so important to be making these connections. What were some of the other goals of the conference? Like what topics were you guys covering and like learning about, you know, early 80s, like thinking about what was even available back then that you guys were focused on?
Well, it was the beginning of the genes being mapped, you know, so it was certainly about that. And as these prenatal tests came along, it was about, and there were so many ethical issues at the time, who was going to be offered an amniocentesis? Was it going to be, in fact, in Los Angeles, again, I was the first gen counselor they hired at UCLA in 1981, and there was a huge controversy because around in this area, they were offering amnios only to women over 37. And then it became, and I don't know about Kansas City, but then it became over women over 35, and then mm-hmm. there became screening tests. So all of that was just so remarkable. And to keep up with that, again, because there was no internet, there was no Google, there was no other way to do it except by having a meeting and spreading the word. And that's how we did it.
And since we were counselors, we were talking to the families and there were support groups there. So what is it? What is the lifetime experience of someone with this condition? What are the nuances of that? Meeting with the different support groups, making sure we were giving accurate information to the patients, and sometimes talking to the researchers and people. There were a lot of special clinics for all the different birth defects, hereditary conditions. So, you know, we would sometimes find out who the genetic counselor was in charge of a cystic fibrosis clinic or whatever kind of clinic in another part of the country. So we could call them and really do kind of case conferences with them.
So did you find through these conferences that was the main source of learning the new information? Because, you know, you couldn't just go onto PubMed like you can today in the early 80s. So was it mostly, would you say, like at NSGC conferences at that point? Or was it a lot of like, oh, a new textbook came out or a new paper that you're physically getting that journal in the mail? Like, how did that work?
It was really all those things. But it was just much more daunting to keep abreast. And you have to remember that there were obviously a lot of patients that we didn't touch at that time at all who lived in rural communities who couldn't make their way into academic centers. So we talk about prenatal diagnosis, but to be honest, at that time, it was really only available to many women who lived in urban areas and not available to people in rural areas at all. For many years. So we had to get together. And, you know, we're really trained in communication. So we are, I think, the best networkers in the world. But we had to be that because that's sort of the way we started.
We did have, like, Smith's book. So we had every syndrome there. And you're pouring through those all the time. And you pretty much had that book memorized to a certain extent. We had online Mendelian inheritance. Well, it wasn't online. Mendelian inheritance in man came in the 1960s. And there was a book. You'd flip to it, whatever the diagnosis was, to try to figure out how might it be inherited. So we got that information from there. And of course, there were at the meetings, they were presenting exceptions. Oh, there's an X-linked form of this, or there's something else. Mm-hmm. So we were doing a lot of counseling about what was the inheritance pattern, X-linked, recessive, or dominant. So that was some of the information, and we would expand on that. And then, of course, where was someone doing the testing? So we used a lot of textbooks. Gorlin had textbooks. You know, there was a lot of books that we were using, shelves of books and reference material.
And then, thank goodness, the first textbooks on genetic counseling became out. Mm-hmm. Deb was instrumental when the internet did start. You want to talk about what you did? Because I remember the day that you put all that stuff together. It was a magical day for all of us, I can tell you.
So I had this website. I was doing the genome project with teachers, and I had all these resources. And of course, from the meetings, you'd have resources. And I realized the internet was the perfect place to put the resources that people could find the information.
So what year was that, Deb?
1996.
Okay.
That's the early days of internet use.
It was. Yes. Like, it was the Gen X Education Center. I wrote the HTML.
Like Gen Z wasn't even born yet. So all you Gen Zers.
So I had a computer. I had to beg to get 3 gigs on it and to get electricity to be able to use it in my office rather than a phone line
and, you know,
with
there
a modem.
These huge things, you know, these PCs were these like huge clunkers, you know.
So got it all, took a while, but I wrote the HTML and just updated it all the time. It ended up being...
I didn't know you were like also casually a like programmer.
Oh, it was amazing. Okay. So I remember the first day in clinic where one of the MD geneticists said, have you seen this new thing? We can go on this and we can look up, you know, Mendelian inheritance of man, and we can look up advocacy groups, right, Deb? And we could look up something about the gene test that might be available. I mean, it was a miracle for us. I can't understate it enough.
I was like invisibly well-known when I'd go to the meetings, you know. I was like, oh, and I'm like, oh, I never knew. I mean, I could see that people were clicking on the links and where they, and I'd rearrange them because nobody was clicking on my big old chromosome page. So I'd move it up to the somewhere so people could find it. And I could see what they were looking for. It was very interesting to see what people were searching for.
So I think you
based
get the title
as
the first digital influencer in genetics.
Could be, yes.
Right?
I think actually.
Michelle, you got to tell me, but yeah.
Yeah,
she really was. Before that, there was really almost nothing. I mean, really, Deb, to be honest. I think she's really underplaying this, but
yeah.
I'm glad
we have
huge...
the two of you on to make sure you're not being too humble to the point we're not getting the information. Like, come on.
It was about 550 pages and 3,000 links. But I had to keep them up because a lot of support groups were a kitchen table situation. And so then somebody else would do it, and then it would be leading to an inappropriate website. So I'd have to update those all the time. And then it was all the international genetic organizations, if you wanted to find that, and lots of lesson plans on genetics, which is kind of what
we don't even have that many pages on our website. And I've been doing this for 10 years. So that's just remarkable.
They only took it down about 2 years ago. It had been up there, but all the links had kind of, you know, I switched positions and really couldn't maintain. And I didn't need to because, you know,
other
Mosaic,
things popped
Netscape,
up,
and then Google.
If you're applying to genetic counseling grad schools in the near future, I highly recommend checking out Sarah Lawrence's Why Genetic Counseling Wednesday Summer Series. This is the fourth year Sarah Lawrence will be hosting this series, where you can interact through Zoom with genetic counselors from different specialties for 2 hours every Wednesday in June. It actually kicks off on Wednesday, May 31st at noon Eastern. As many of you know, I graduated from Sarah Lawrence's program 3 years ago, and this series was a fun way to interact with prospective genetic counseling students, and I'm really looking forward to meeting more of you during this series. Myself and fellow genetic counselors will share about our roles and answer your questions live. Not only will you hear from GCs in a variety of specialties, you'll also have the opportunity to discuss ethical and social implications of genomic medicine, engage with current students, and learn about the exciting present and projected future of the profession. Anyone who attends all 5 will earn a certificate of completion and receive an application fee waiver for the grad program in the fall. Register now before we are fully booked. Go to slc.edu/DNA today. Again, that's slc.edu/DNA today to be part of this interactive genetic counseling experience. Are you seeking a position as a genetic assistant or want to bolster your resume for genetic counseling grad school applications? People in these vital roles aid with clinical and research patient communication, data entry, genetic testing coordination, and administrative tasks. Therefore, training is key. We recommend the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Be part of a cohort learning the knowledge and skills necessary to be a genetic assistant, or buy a seat for your employees who need job training. This program consists of 2 10-week instructor-led courses. All you need is a basic understanding of science, particularly biology. At the successful completion of the program, learners will receive a certificate of completion from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the McCusick-Nathans Department of Genetic Medicine. Applications are open now for the summer cohort, which starts June 5th, 2023. Don't wait. Check out the Genetic Assistant Online Training Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine now. Click the link in the show notes for this episode for more information. You can also access that link via the blog post for this episode available at dnatoday.com. Yeah, well, interesting. So then, you know, circling back to kind of like the meeting with everything, nowadays we have a lot of administrative support from what I understand to plan the NSGC meetings. And like, it's quite a feat to be planning these conferences, especially for, I don't know how many people attend every year, but it's a large chunk of, you know, the 5,000 of
us. It's a couple thousand, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, and you have people that aren't genetic counselors coming too and everything. So, so, you know, back in the early 80s, like, who was planning and orchestrating the meetings? Was it genetic counselors, like, taking on this role?
It sure was. It sure was. Wow. You know, Deb was a NSGC president, and she
88?
Can tell you,
am I getting that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She can tell you what went in to being a president of NSGC, okay? And if you didn't have a workplace that supported you, it was very, very difficult because, I mean, it was pretty much, it's always been pretty much a full-time job to be an NSGC president plus have a day job, you know? It very, very time-consuming.
I worked with a fabulous geneticist, Neil Shimke, and was completely supportive of every single thing I did, understood the world needed to know about genetics, education. When I was writing grants, didn't know how to write a grant, figured out how to write a big old grant from the Human Genome Project and things like that. So it was always just, I think I was like everybody else. I just was doing a little different thing than everybody else, whatever the need was. But we had secretaries shared resources with the department, but there was someone who could help with some of the details from that standpoint. And then everybody that was ahead of a committee was working on it similarly. So we all had kind of either our individual person, family, or workforce that they utilized. Some people might have had students. I don't remember students being involved particularly.
To be honest, even to this day, Kira, I rolled off the board on the board of directors in 2021. And everybody works so hard as a volunteer for NSGC. I mean, some of them are very labor intensive and some are not, but it's a huge volunteer support that keeps the organization afloat.
Yeah, even to this day. Yeah, I didn't mean to diminish it earlier. I think you bring up a good point that it's like, you know, I think it seems like there's more administrative support with like the companies that also work with NSGC.
You
guys didn't have
company.
Any of that
absolutely.
Back then.
No, yeah. No. Absolutely. But, you know, I think this profession attracts people that are idea people. They see things that can be changed, and so they have ideas. So that's what you were kind of navigating, is that somebody had a good idea, wanted to write a policy statement or wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to figure out, well, do we need does that fit with the existing structure? Do we need to have an ad hoc committee? And who's that going to mm-hmm. be? And how are they going to give feedback? That hasn't really changed. People with ideas are still trying to make a difference and expand things. And I think it's the nature of the profession is people are just
I think you can't be anything but a lifelong learner and be comfortable with ambiguity, because you have to remember, we've always have ambiguous genetic test reports. You know, people argue about variants of unknown significance now. We had chromosomes that nobody knew. It was a little bit this, a little bit of that.
What's that marker?
Really missing? What was that? You know, what about these, you know,
especially
telomeres?
Before you had band for band. I have a background in cyto. So for a while, it was just solid banding. And you're I guess we're missing this one or something, right? And it's
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've spent way too many hours on a microscope band for band, and I'm not very good at it, like just good enough to pass a certification exam, but
it's
barely.
It's really, really tough, very tough. So you have to be a little bit comfortable with that, I think.
So tell me more about then what the next few years of the conference were like kind of late 80s, early 90s, like still early days.
Days. But then we did in, I think it was 93, we finally broke off from ASHG and had our own meeting because it really got too long and people couldn't leave their jobs for over a week to go to ASHG and NSGC. So that was probably the first year, I think, that we had our freestanding meeting. And they just became more and more sophisticated over time with workshops and policy groups and the special interest groups, so much more diverse. And so much went on at the meetings. But it was still, oh, and then all the programs started to have reunions, and that was amazing. So to see everybody from your class and to hang out and then see all the new people, I mean, that was just, you know, an amazing
It's still my favorite
advance.
Part of the conference.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. And especially now that I've graduated, I'm like, oh, all my people, you know? Yeah.
And you know, we talk about that, your cohort is that, your class is a big deal of your identity. I think it is for me and Deb.
I agree with that. Both me and us. My 29 best friends.
Well, our class was, well, it depended because there were 3 and 4 year students as well, but approximately about 22-ish. Mm-hmm. And about 18.
That's bigger than I would have thought back then.
Oh, yeah. They were all almost every year, except the very, very beginning, Kira, were 25. And that's
Whoa.
How we got to, in 2019, 1,000 genetic counselors out of 5,000 have trained at Sarah Lawrence.
I mean, one in doubt.
We are formidable.
Yeah. I mean, and even earlier than that, it was like the majority. Like, you know, every year with more people, it's less and less, but still a fifth of genetic counselors in America trained by
the
SLC.
And there were usually about 18 of our classmates there. And then we would meet people they worked with, and we knew the class before us and the class after us.
Yep.
So there was quite a few people that we would see at the meetings. And so the networking, as I'm thinking about this, we really facilitated networking throughout the country because we all were there in all these different places.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what I really missed about having the virtual conferences for the two COVID heavier years, which for what it was, it really was great. Like the level of networking from virtual was awesome, but nothing can replace the in-person experience. No. And it's just, I mean, the networking is just fantastic. It's like, I don't leave the exhibit hall. And I'm like, I got to go to the meetings, but now they record them too, which is nice and everything. So
you get there and everybody knows this, you get to the registration desk and you just hear the squeals.
Yeah. Yep.
Everybody's
yeah,
screaming
constant,
and
right? That first 24 hours.
Crazy. It's great.
Oh, it's amazing. So one thing I really wanted to ask you guys, you know, as we're closing out the episode here, like if you went back in time to the first conference in 1981, like as you are now, you get in the time machine and you go back and you told yourself something, what would surprise you most about the field of genetic counseling today? Like 50
well,
years now in the future, 54 years.
What surprises me the most is that with the genetic counseling that I do, and, you know, now I'm working as a consultant for a genetic testing laboratory, so I'm not actively counseling patients. But when I was at UCLA, the fact that we have treatment for so many genetic diseases, I would have never seen that coming down the pike, and makes me feel so grateful. Treatment for Leber's congenital amaurosis, SMA, the lysosomal storage diseases. I mean, just amazing. Just amazing.
Von Hippel-Lindau.
Neurofibromatosis. Now we have some drug for plexiform neurofibromas. What an amazing, amazing thing. And I never anticipated that.
Especially with
that.
Rare diseases. Like, you know, when you're talking about diseases that only affect so many people in the world, it's like to be able to develop a treatment is just really astounding. Even like these N of, like, I know Enlorum out of California does like N of one developments.
Yes.
And it's just like that. That's something that I would have been shocked about even like 3 years ago.
Absolutely.
So it's just, it's crazy. But what about
Absolutely.
You, Deborah?
Well, I think that is definitely true. The other is, I think there's so much technology to learn. So for the current people that are graduating, it's just so many kinds of testing. But what's wonderful to me is it's so much easier to do the testing. Insurance is covering a lot of these testing, and the prices drop tremendously. So the technology has really made a difference. And I think more people are aware of genetics, the combination of hearing about 23andMe and Ancestry and just being able
and COVID
to
testing mRNA
and some of the big cases in the news, but it's really in the news. People are always saying it's in their DNA, you know, that phrase, it's just everywhere, but people don't know exactly what it is. And so when we're explaining it to them, it clarifies what that means. But I think we're really fortunate that there's this background now where people kind of have a sense of what it is. We're kind of tweaking the information that they have. And we have a lot to offer them. That's, I think, we have so much, because we were really talking about inheritance patterns. You know, now we're really talking about very specific testing, digging in even deeper, and then finding out things, and that preventative aspect of knowing, in my world, I work in the cancer center, so all the family members that we can start screening early and do prevention. It's not inevitable. It's like identifying people that we can really offer something to.
Yeah, and then when you think about it, there weren't any genetic counselor doing cancer till many, many years after we started. And that really made us vital to oncologists, because now it's part of the treatment. You have to know, you really want to know if you have BRCA1 or 2 before you look at your options, treatment options. And so that really was a remarkable change. For the broader world of cancer genetics, and now moving into cardiogenetics.
Yeah, and we just see more and more specialties being added to that list where, you know, it used to be like, oh, cardio is so small, and now it's like it's grown so much. Like, that's a great example, Michelle. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm realizing we're kind of short on time, but I have one more question for you guys. So, you know, we've talked about what we've looked at the past, you know, 54 years. What about the next 50 years? Like, are there different things that you guys have thought about, like, in 50 years, I think this will be standard, or we would have achieved this, or we'll have this technology? Like, is there anything that comes to mind? Curveball question, because we did not, you know, say this ahead of time.
Yeah, well, I tell you what I think is going to happen, and I don't think it's that far in the future. Everybody's going to have their genome done. It's just going to happen. I mean, it's going to be part, you know, we always talk about we're moving into mainstream medicine. Where I can tell you we're not in mainstream medicine, okay? But we have to have a lot of things happen before we move into mainstream medicine. But if everybody does have their genome sequence, and maybe as part of newborn screening or however it comes down the pike, there's no better people to explain all of that to everyone, the healthcare providers, the patients, the families, but genetic counselors.
That's what I feel very similar. We're all, you know, it's going to be prenatal or at birth, and then things will be rolled out as appropriate. So at what do you need to know in utero? What do you need to know in the first 5 years of life? And then what does a teenager need to know? And then in the early 20s. And then we'll probably have a lot more information for people over 60 or 70 that don't always get all the research funding sometimes. But I think because the information changes so quickly, you don't want to tell a parent of a two-year-old something like, when they're 30 years old, this is what's going to happen. So I don't think they're going to get all, my guess is genetic counselors will be part of that. We're not trying to withhold information, but give it at the appropriate time. Explain why we're not rolling it out yet, because we're not going to do anything for 20 years. And at that time, at the appropriate time, and people will need to be staying in touch, I think, with the genetic counselors.
So
more
what
than
if
they
everybody
do.
Had a genetic counselor, like they have a financial advisor?
Yes.
You know, yeah. So that
or like
person
your GP.
Is their person. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could
yeah,
be doing
I,
that.
I can mm-hmm. see that. Yeah, I think we're going to see it. I've mentioned on other episodes. I think we're going to see this in places with universal healthcare first, because mm-hmm. then the government has information. Yes. Then you can follow that person. And I don't think the U.S. is going to be the first country to do it where everybody mm-hmm. has it. And it's just part of, like, you know, standard workflow, like newborn screening, because we're just so big and we don't have universal healthcare. Everything's in one place. So I feel like UK, Canada, like maybe, you know, somewhere kind of over there, we'll see it first. But yeah, very, very interesting. And a lot of guests have brought this up. So I completely agree with you guys. And I did look it up. I mentioned earlier in the episode, wanted to give a shout out to episode 136 with Linda Robinson, because we kind of we talked about
Linda.
Very different things. But yeah, Linda's amazing. So she talked about the history of the genetic counseling field, kind of, you know, similar to this episode, but we really talked about different topics. And also wanted to recommend episode 31 with Robin Schwartz. She worked at UConn Health for 41 years. I'm trying to remember now. And she's awesome. She's the first cancer genetic counselor I ever interviewed. So my interview skills, not so great, but hey, she gave great information and kind of shared her perspective as another OG genetic counselor. And so, you know, we've mentioned formation of ABGC. So we're going to actually dive into that more in the next episode with Ed Cloza and Ann Walker. Did I pronounce their names right?
You did.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, tune into the next episode. We're going to kind of continue on this time machine. But thank you both for coming on. I mean, this was such a treat
thank
for me
you.
To
oh,
be
wonderful.
Able to just hear you guys just nerd out and just get so excited about the history. And I say that in a very positive way. I'm a nerd and proud of it. But yeah, this is just really cool. And I think it's just so important that we do document this. And we're doing this as part of kind of through which SIG is it through NSGC that we're doing this through? You have
Late
to
career.
Remind me now.
Late career.
There we go. Had a brain blip there, end of the day. But yeah, so I think it's just really, really important that we document this. And this is just, I was looking forward to this all day. So thank you guys so much for coming on.
Us too. Thanks so much.
As many of you know, through podcasting, I've become an entrepreneur, including consulting for other podcasts. Since I don't have a business degree, I've learned a lot through podcasts like Porch Talks. The inspiration to start this show was from the host, Melissa Bradley, who wanted to inform, instruct, and inspire fellow entrepreneurs, especially people who identify as women, people of color, immigrants, veterans, people with disabilities, and folks in the LGBTQIA+ community, which drew me initially. So if you're thinking about starting a business or just love hearing stories about how businesses grow, Porch Talks is for you. Search Porch Talks in your podcast player or use the links in the show notes to start listening. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.